Prove it, peeps. Welcome to today's episode of the Improve It podcast. If you are new here, welcome. If you are an OG Improve It peep, I am so happy you're here. This is April, and this month on the show, we're talking about openness to new ideas, new beginnings. It's spring, and it's time to emerge and bloom, my friends. Grow where you are planted. You know, all the metaphors. I would go down a metaphor rabbit hole if I had all the time in the world. But maybe you are a person who pressed play today and you're thinking, you know what, Erin, I would love to try something new. Or, Erin, I would love to stop spending my time binging social media or the news and I'm looking for a mindset shift. Or, I'm not really ready for change. I'm not sure how to do that or become more open to new ideas or experiences. I just want to hear what you have to say and this expert has to say, and maybe I'll open my mind afterwards. Amazing. If this sounds like you in any way, shape, or form, get out a pen and a paper because today is going to blow your mind. Today, we are talking about expanding our mind in a world filled with distractions. My guest today is Dr. Nate Klemp, a writer, philosopher, and entrepreneur. He is the author of the new book, Open: Living with an Expansive Mind in a Distracted World. Now, at Improve It, not just our podcast, but the company I run, Improve It, we pride ourselves on getting comfortable with the uncomfortable. And let me tell you, improv is not for the faint of heart. And it's not lost on me that improvisers have to have an expansive mind and are some of the most open people you will meet. You have to be open in your heart and mind to play different characters, take the scene to new locations, and expand yourself on stage. But if today's episode scares you for whatever reason, if you're resistant to change or resistant to hearing different political views than your own, consider this my personal invitation. I'm grabbing your hand. I'm going to guide you ever so gently outside of that comfort zone because it's outside of that zone that the magic happens. Let's get to improving it with my special guest, Dr. Nate Klemp. Nate, Dr. Nate, I'm going to give you your formal introduction. Then I'm going to go Nate. Welcome to the Improve It podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Erin. It's a joy to be here.
Oh my God. Well, you were a joy to prep for. I'm not going to lie to you. I was so interested in this concept and you inspired this monthly theme of openness here on the show. I love to start every episode by setting a one-word intention for the show. So what is one word that you want to give yourself and our audience today?
Well, let's go with the word open.
Yeah.
That's the title of my new book, but it's also a concept that's so rich. So it's got this long scientific history. So most people don't know this, but in psychology, they have what's called the big five traits of personality. The first is introversion versus extroversion. We all know about that, right? We talk about that ad nauseum. But the final of the big five personality traits is, guess what? Openness versus closeness to experience. So this is not just like some out there crazy spiritual thing, but this is actually a centerpiece of human psychology. It's a personality trait. It's a practice, I think. So I know we'll get into all the different dimensions of it, but for this month, I love the idea of exploring what is it like to open instead of close to life, to our own mind, to other people who disagree with us, with that, what does that full experience feel like?
I am so down for this conversation, and it could not come at a more pinnacle time. I feel like this, I needed this today, Nate. Okay, like selfishly, sometimes I do shows for my peeps. Today, I need this. So, when you think of this word openness, what does it mean to you specifically? I know you've got the science behind it, but for Nate, inside, what does openness mean to you?
Well, in some ways, we can get there by also talking about closed, because I think there are two important words here. One is closed, one is open. And these are two experiences we're all familiar with. And the reason I thought this was such an interesting distinction or project to investigate is that I found myself, in spite of having gotten a PhD in philosophy and having meditated and done yoga for 15 years, I found myself just closing. And what I mean by that, there's sort of two dimensions to it. One is this experience of closure we're having in the form of screen addiction, the craving we have for our screen. So we feel a little bit uncomfortable, a little bit anxious, whip out our screen, right? Yeah. Self-medicate through some novelty through our screen. So that's one dimension. The other dimension is a form of closing, not so much to our own mind, but to other people. And that I like to describe as political polarization, which is something we're all also familiar with, right? Like, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, somebody disagreed with you and they had a different perspective. Now they're like the enemy, you know, and there's something wrong with them. They're just a misguided moron or whatever. So the invitation here with opening is to see if we can begin to unwind the momentum of closure. And that's why I think it's important to talk about closure. These two forces of closure have tremendous momentum in our modern age. A lot of that's because of technology. A lot of that's because of the movement of politics. But the project that I think is really interesting is interrupting the momentum of closure, step one. Step two, finding practices and tools we can use to sort of have a more expansive view of life, be more open to other people who might disagree with us.
I love this so much. Never before in my adult life had we ever felt more of a divisive culture than I think 2020 was. The 2016 through 2020 politically, I think, was a extremely tumultuous time. On top of that, the isolation of the pandemic. Yep.
Well, and here comes 2024.
I know, right? I know. So, and I want to get into the experiment that you did. We're going to talk about that because I think it's so fascinating. But I love that we're having to look at closure in order to really understand open and openness. And I like that when you're saying openness, you're not necessarily saying one side is better than the other. It's let me look at both sides. Is that where you're going?
Yeah. And I also think it's totally legitimate and important to have strong views and opinions, you know, to have beliefs about politics that are important to you. So what I'm saying is not you should have like no strong political opinion. You should be neutral or what, something like that, or that you should adopt the views of the other side that you think are so horrendous. It's more, we're so basically stuck in this strategic frame of politics where it's all about winning for our side, making sure the other side loses, that I think we've lost this skill of actually listening to somebody who might disagree with us. And the statistics here, I think, are worth mentioning because they're kind of eye-popping. So in 1980, Gallup ran a survey. They found 47% of Americans felt warm and favorable toward the other political party. 2020, that number drops in half to 25%. And then there's this other study that's even crazier. Some political scientists wrote a paper called Lethal Mass Partisanship. And they found that about 20% of Democrats and Republicans believe that the other side lacks the basic traits to be human, that they behave like animals, and that we would be better off if large percentages of the other side simply died. Right? So that's 20%. That is a lot. And those are the conditions we live in. So I guess the idea here is, again, not that you have to stop believing what you believe, but that maybe it's useful every once in a while for all of us to consider actually engaging and listening to people who might not share our political views.
So interesting. Do you have a specific experience in your own life that you can think of where you really had to lean into this idea of openness?
Absolutely. Well, in the political realm for this book project, just full disclosure here, I live in Boulder, Colorado, kind of left-leaning town. I am generally a proponent of things like gun control. So I thought it would be really interesting and helpful for me to just get a full-on experience of immersing myself on the other side. Because there's not a whole lot of diversity politically here in Boulder. Everybody kind of thinks the same.
Sure.
So I ended up signing up for a National Rifle Association training to get my concealed carry permit. And I ended up spending quite a bit of time with people who had very different beliefs. And I learned a few pretty interesting things. So one thing I learned is that the National Rifle Association was way more moderate in the way they were teaching us to use guns than I had thought. Like the basic message of the course was like, don't use your firearm. Do everything you can to avoid using your firearm. So that was interesting. The second thing I learned is that I started to see the essence of the difference between our views. And it wasn't really about guns. It was more about human nature. So everybody else in the class had this view that like we're kind of living in this like dystopian hellscape where you're always just one Walmart trip away from being like abducted and shot in a dark alley and nobody else is going to protect you. So you should do it for yourself. And I kind of had this view of human nature that like, yeah, the world's kind of crazy, like, you know, crime happens, but for the most part, everything's pretty good. And, you know, I don't really need to worry about protecting myself. And so that was the essence of our disagreement. Finally, this is just the last point I want to make about that experience. I had, in the end, this experience of getting to really know some of these folks, having lunch with them, talking about our marriage, in addition to, you know, like Trump and various other conspiracy theories and things like that. And I just realized on a deep level that we are all the same. We are all human beings doing our best in a very crazy world and that there is no enemy. And for me, that was just like mind blowing. I could never see politics the same way after that experience.
Okay. You're hitting a woo-woo nerve for me here. And I love it so much because I truly believe that. I believe that obviously, political views are meant to divide. They're meant to increase fear. We're talking about the other component, our opponent. There's no love, and there's only two emotions really that make up the human being experience: fear and love. And you can choose to be in the stream of well-being and flow with the stream of love, or you can choose fear. And I think what you kind of got to with this experiment was that we are all human beings. We all want to feel connected and loved, but having that openness to go through that. And I come from a similar space. I come from Chicago. Okay. Very liberal town, city. And then I moved to Charleston, South Carolina in 2020. So it was a very interesting experience as well. I find that when you lead with love and you lead with a genuine curiosity of the human being, we are all wanting the same things, this desire to feel connection. And so through that experiment, did you have, just out of curiosity for you, when you went back to Boulder and you shared your experience with other people, what was that like?
Well, most people had the reaction of, wow, I should do that. Why am I not doing something like that? And then, you know, there are a small percentage of people who had the reaction of, how can you even talk to these people? How could you give money to the National Rifle Association, right? This kind of like instinctual outrage reaction. So it was mixed, but that was how people reacted.
It's very cool that you did that. I want to talk about too, because when we talk about this idea of closed versus opened, you also, obviously a big part of the book is overcoming distractions in such a distracted world. So with today, like when you even talked about earlier, technology at our fingertips, you made me think of, I live in a neighborhood filled with kids and I'll run in the morning. And they'll all be at the bus stop. None of them are talking. All of them middle school and up, are on their phones. Literally not looking at each other, not talking. What are some strategies that we can use to filter through this noise and focus on human beings and connecting?
Yeah. Well, I want to answer that question, but first I also want to just sketch out a little bit of context here to show why this is such a profound problem for all of us these days. So the first thing is the statistics here are really fascinating. So Nielsen estimates the average American spends 11 hours a day on screens.
Oh,
they've also found that about 50% of teenagers describe themselves as having a significant addiction to their screen. And then there have been these studies where they pose these kind of like, would you rather dilemmas to people? So would you rather spend a month without your smartphone or your pet? 40% of people choose their phone over their pet. Would you rather spend a month without your significant other or your pet? 44% of people choose their phone over their significant other. Would you rather have a month without sex or your smartphone? 56% choose their phone over sex. And in one study, they found 10% of people would rather amputate a finger of their own choosing, like cut off their own finger, than go without their phone. All right. So all of that is to say, you know, sometimes people try to minimize this, like, we've always had technology. It's not that big of a deal, whatever. I think it's a big deal. I think it's a really, really big deal. And it's not just that we're distracted, to your point. It's that we crave distraction. And I think the difference there is crucial, that for many of us, we're experiencing a behavioral addiction to our screens. So I just like to lead with that as the context, because I think that helps answer the question of like, well, why should we think about strategies? Well, we should think about strategies because we may be losing our basic freedom as human beings. So, so it's worth checking this out. So in terms of strategies, the big idea here is thinking about ways we can redesign our environment. This is sometimes called behavioral architecture, to make it easier to focus on the things that matter and create a little bit of friction in between us and our screens. So one way we can look at this is in our physical space, like thinking about how could our physical space be more conducive to focus and things like that. So one tip that I always recommend is kick your phones out of your bedroom. That's like step one. You can have an alarm clock. That'll help you wake up, but like kick those out of the bedroom. Have a place in your house where you can like leave your phone so you're not carrying it around the whole time. The other thing is to think about like how you design your time. So one of the tools I've used that I think can be really useful here is actually setting aside time each day for distraction. So like in the middle of the day when I'm eating lunch, that's my distraction zone. I allow myself to just completely gorge on quick hits of Instagram and news and all that stuff. But as a result, like in the morning when I have those urges, I know, you know, my dopamine dessert is coming. I don't need to do that now. And then finally, I think there are ways we can redesign our devices themselves, right? So you can silence all non-essential notifications. There's no need to get a notification every time you're emailed or something like that. Move all the distracting apps off your home screen. You can use focus mode. You can use do not disturb. You can go grayscale if you really want and turn your phone into black and white, or go with a flip phone, right? There's some more radical things you can do. But the basic idea there is just like really thinking about the environment that you're in, that you've created for yourself, and how to create friction between you and your phone.
Okay, I love that you used the words dopamine dessert.
Dopamine dessert, yeah.
That is incredible. I'm never forgetting that. Dopamine dessert. I will give you the credit, okay? That is hilarious.
All right.
Number one, and it's so true. And then, okay, I have so many thoughts on this. Like, I could spend the entire episode dissecting this, so I'm just going to go super high level. First and foremost, I'm addicted to my phone.
Yeah, I am too.
That person.
I am with you.
I wouldn't lose a limb. Okay, that's as far as I would go.
So you're not going to cut your finger off.
Right. Ask me on a bad day, maybe I'd give my partner away. I don't know. I love my husband. Just kidding. No, but I love you, John. But like, I truly feel addicted personally. I know so many people listening to this. Hopefully you don't feel addicted, but I know many people who are working parents specifically, we're tied to our phones because sometimes we have to leave work because we need to take care of our families. And so work is on our phones, so we can't be with our kids and not have our phone. And then when we are with our kids, we're looking at our work. And when we're at work, we're wondering, is school going to call today? Is he coming home sick again? It's so hard to just not have that. And I think back, I was born an early 80s baby. We had a landline, okay? And like, that was it. There was cable television and we survived. So this addiction is so real. And I found myself putting up boundaries, like you've mentioned. I will put my phone in my office from 5:30 to 8 every, I've started doing this, have not been doing it as a habit. It's hopefully a habit because that's my time for my family. When I make dinner, we go for a bike ride. That 2.5 hours of no screens feels amazing. But you know what I do at 8:15 when my son is tucked in? Boop, scroll, editing videos, you know, doing all the things. It is such an addiction. And those are some really great things that we have to put in practice. I think it comes with the dopamine dessert. Another D would be discipline. Like,
well, can I give you another crazier strategy?
Yes, help me.
I'm going to give you one that's like kind of bonkers. Are you open to that?
Yeah. Give me the bonkers.
So,
I'm here for
you. So in the context of this book, I write about this in the first few chapters. I thought it would be interesting to go the other way. So all the screen addiction tactics I just gave you, they're all about restraint. They're all about like fasting from your devices, all that. And that's really good. I think we need that. But there's also like this energy that's created when you really try to restrain yourself from something, you know, like with dieting and stuff like that, where you're like, I don't want to eat the cake. I don't want to eat the cake. And now you really want to eat the cake. Like there's a way in which restraint can intensify desire.
Yeah, then you stick your face in the cake and you're like, I'm here for this cake.
Exactly.
Okay, keep going.
So what I thought would be really interesting is there's this old technique, you know, like old school parenting, they would say, you catch your kid smoking a pack of cigarettes, have them finish the whole pack or smoke 2 packs and they'll never smoke again, right? Terrible parenting advice, not endorsing that. But it turns out this technique has a long history in the tradition of Tantric Buddhism, where they thought, instead of restraining, wouldn't it be interesting if we kind of consciously indulge? So they would do this with things like sex and drinking and decadent eating. But I thought, like, wouldn't that be interesting to do this with screens? And the idea is, if you kind of overindulge, can you burn out the root of the desire? So what I did is I spent 3 days all day every day just binging on screens and political outrage. And a couple of really interesting things happened. One, I realized that the connection between our screens and sleep is no joke. Because when I really overindulged, I basically couldn't sleep. I was up every night at 2:40 and there was like no going back to sleep. So that was really interesting. But the bigger lesson I learned is that the thing that keeps us coming back to our screen is novelty. And in a way, it's very similar to like a gambling addiction in the sense that you see somebody at the slot machine, they keep pulling the lever, putting in the coin, pulling the lever, putting in the coin. What are they addicted to? They're addicted to that moment where they see something new, where the wheels stop and they're like, oh, I won, or oh, I didn't win. And our phones are the same. We pick up the phone and it's like, there's something new in the text message app. There's something new in our email app. Go to Instagram. There's a fresh social media feed, right? We're addicted to this experience of novelty. And so by overindulging and going all the way with my phone, I found that in a way I destroyed its superpower, because at a certain point there was nothing new for me to see. I had seen it all. And after the experiment, I had a morning where I woke up and I had this thought like, oh, this is where I usually grab my phone and go to the bathroom. And the desire for the first time in a decade just completely fell flat. So all that is to say that there's another way you can go. It's pretty radical, but it's like, instead of pulling away, you can experiment with going in even more than what you usually do. And then there's a kind of revulsion that can happen that can be useful.
You know what? First of all, I read that about you and I was fascinated to know this journey. Yes. So thank you, because I was going to ask you that. Okay. So many thoughts here, because it reminds me of when the pandemic hit in 2020. I don't know about you, but literally people were coming out of the woodwork for me. Like high school friends were like, let's have a Zoom happy hour.
Yeah, Zoom
like,
happy hour.
Right, the craze, right? Because we couldn't leave our houses. We were glued to our phones. On top of the fact it was a political year, things that we had a social pandemic, we had a health pandemic, we had all of these pandemics happening. And the only thing we could do to connect ourselves was our phone and was Zoom and apps like Riverside, which we're recording on now. I remember also our company created something called Laugh Breaks during that time, which was we basically Zoomed bombed your team meetings with laughter. Okay. Like we were, it was all short form improv. When I tell you that in 2020, we sold hundreds of these, I mean, we sold hundreds and they were nominally priced because people were glued to their screens. And it reminds me of that time, because I'll tell you what, no one wants a laugh break in 2024 anymore. No,
no one wants to do Zoom happy hour. It's like, no one wants to do Zoom
happy hour. Yeah, absolutely not. I feel like we went through a mini version of that, like as a society in 2020. And I will tell you, like, there will be some vacations that I say, I'm putting my phone down. I will check text and that is it. When I get back from those vacations, I feel completely restored. When I was in the 2020 state, like thinking back actually gives me hives because I was so sick of screens at that time. I didn't even want to look at my phone, but it was all I had to connect with the outside world. So your experiment, I feel like, would be interesting to do today. And I'm pretty sure everyone would have that same finding, because we all had a mini crash course in 2020 when we were just stuck. Yeah. We could not do anything but look at the screen.
I love the connection between that experiment and what we experienced in 2020. I think that's totally true. And I think the bigger practice here, or the bigger insight, is just that anything you can do to disrupt your ordinary habits, whether that is through the fasting side, by like, I'm going to lock my phone up and I'm not going to touch it, or through the indulgence side, I'm going to overindulge, both of those are outside of your normal habits. And so you could put them together, you could do one or the other, but the basic idea is to do something that just kind of disrupts the ordinary flow of habit so that you have a little bit more perspective on like, wow, this is not the way I want to live. And what can I do to shift that?
I love this. Like, this is going to hit with so many people. Your book is coming out at the perfect time, by the way. I'm so excited. It will have launched by the time this episode airs, launches February 13th, which is Galentine's Day, by
Galentine's
Day.
All right.
Galentine's Day. I want to talk about this rise of a distraction culture, this dopamine dessert that we all crave, right? And I want to talk about something that I think will hit with a lot of our listeners. We call ourselves the Improve It Peeps. Comparisonitis. As leaders, look, I can be crushing it. Let me talk for myself, okay? I'll speak for everyone, but on a day that I am crushing it, I'm having the best day. You know, things have come in from clients. We've gotten great client feedback. We're booking stuff. We're feeling good. I can turn on my social media. I can literally go on Instagram and I can see my colleague, Susan. Same space, doing something better. And now, guess whose day has a little dopamine downer? This girl. Who's got two thumbs and a dopamine downer? Me. And it is, I know I'm not alone. I know I've heard from so many people. We're all in different life stages. So depending on what life stage that you're in, it could be, oh my gosh, she's engaged and I'm not. Oh my gosh, she's pregnant and I'm not. It could be, oh, she's gotten that promotion or she's launching that thing. I'm not. Like, there's so many different types of comparison. But what are some tips? Like, I need some solid tips about embracing openness and not falling into that constant comparison trap.
Yeah, well, amen to everything you said. As a writer, I am constantly caught in that same game. You know, this person, they sold way more books than me. They have so many more followers than me. They, you know, they have all these awards that I don't, et cetera, et cetera. And you're right that we've always had that problem, but now we have technologies designed to amplify that problem, right? So to your point, you go on Instagram, you see these people who are living seemingly amazing lives, knowing in the back of your mind that it's all kind of like BS, you know, that behind that picture, there's really like a lot of relationship conflict or whatever, but you don't get to see that, unfortunately. And so, yeah, to your point, this is, it's a problem that I think is, we've always had. It's innate in the human mind, but we've like turned the volume way up on it. So how do we mitigate that problem? Well, I think one thing is, I call virtual space Screenland. I just, that's like my cute name for it. And part of the reason I do that is as a reminder to myself, like, okay, I'm going to Screenland right now. I'm not going to reality. I'm going, it's like when I go to Disney World, you know, I don't think Mickey Mouse is like hopping around at Disney World. It's a dude in a costume, right? So, when we go to Screenland, I think let's just be clear on where we're going. We're not going to reality. Yeah. We're going to like this weird, it's like Disneyland, but designed to make us feel bad about ourselves or something. Like that's how I describe it. So let's get that awareness first. Like this is Screenland. This is not reality. But then I think in our actual life, having some practices we can rely on that kind of ground us and get us out of that trap. And I think there are a lot of different ways to do this. You know, getting out in nature for me is such a powerful practice. Meditation for me has been a very powerful practice. Anything I can do to just like come back to the present moment, hanging out with my daughter, you know, my wife, such a powerful practice. So I think it's like, you know, to a certain extent, we're torturing ourselves a little bit with respect to comparison if we're spending so much time on screens and we're not creating these other rituals in our life that feel a little bit more real, that ground us, you know, that remind us like, hey, we're okay. I don't need a million followers to be a good person or a good writer. I can be okay just as I am.
I love that. It's a great reminder for me today. Again, I'm sorry, Improve It peeps. I needed this one. I know you needed it too. I look to my microphone when I talk to the audience, like I'm talking, like
they're over right there. Yeah, totally.
I feel you. It's such, you know, it's almost like you're in high school and sometimes you see the cool kids and you're like, I want to be a part of the cool kid club. But you are a cool kid. Like you're out there crushing it, right? Nate, I'm just saying like for you, for example, as an author. And there's so many things that when we get back to reality that ground us and give us that peace. So I also love that idea of saying Screenland. I'm going to say that because that's like such a good idea.
Well, the other thing is like I've had that thought a lot that it's a lot like high school. But then I started to realize, no, it's not exactly like high school because if you go on Instagram, the first thing you see is like a number that tells you how cool this person is, right? So you see they have like 4,000 likes and 400 comments and you go to their profile, you see they have 500,000 followers. So to me, it's more like if you were in high school and you went to the cafeteria and everybody had like a score on their shirt, like big score with like, I'm a 9.5 in terms of popularity. And you had like a 7.2 or a 5. Like that's what it's actually like, which is even more intense than high school where you kind of knew because like whatever, people were wearing a certain brand of clothes or they were hanging out with certain other people. But it was still like a little bit mysterious. You know, it wasn't just like spelled out in numbers that way.
Okay. This is not where I wanted to take this, but it feels like I need to ask you this because I have a 4-year-old son. How old's your daughter?
She's 12.
She's 12. Does she have a phone? Does she use social media?
So my daughter has an Apple Watch because we realized that it's really tricky with kids, especially once you get around 10 and over. There are two dangers, as far as I can tell. Danger one is you let them just have a smartphone, lie about their age and get on Instagram, because the age minimum technically is 13, but all the kids lie now, or TikTok or whatever. So that path, I think, is super dangerous. I would not want to subject my child to that. But there's another path that feels kind of dangerous, which is to say, no, you can't have a phone, you can't have text, you can't have any way of communicating with your friends. You're going to be this kind of like loner who's adrift, you know, and doesn't really have a way of being a part of a social group. So like you're choosing between like ostracism and just like becoming a complete screen addict. So I think knowing that those are the two extremes, the goal we've tried to aspire toward is like this kind of middle way. So she has an Apple phone, she can text, she doesn't have any social media. So that's about all she has. Once she gets to eighth grade, we'll probably do the smartphone thing, but I will try my best to keep her off social media. So that's just my perspective on it, but it's tricky.
I love that. I'm curious because I obviously am not there yet. And I wonder people, you know, our listeners listening, what they're doing for their own kids, because it is like, for me, Facebook didn't exist until I graduated college. Like, thank God. I was going on AOL. You know, I was in 17 magazine chat rooms with the dial-up internet when I was in high school. You know, like it was still the rah, rah, rah. And I'm so glad because it's just like, it's just so hard for a parent to watch that and to know we really, in such a distracted world, we as adults can understand. But I feel like as a mind that's still developing, that's a whole other subject. And I hope you write a book about that. I hope that's your next book. You got a marriage book. We need an open book. And then we need help the parents of this totally. Generation with distractions, because it's so hard. It's hard for me as a 41-year-old woman, you know, like, so I love that you've given us all these tips and tricks. I have one final question for you. Have you ever done improv? And this is a fun thing I want to do because you're launching your book and I love to do this with authors. This is a little improv game. You have not done improvisation as an actor, but you've done improv as a jazz musician. So this will be very easy because it's about you. This is a little ditty I call Five Facts. I'm going to do a little ditty. After I do the five facts, little ditty, I want you to give me five facts about the book that we can't find anywhere online. And it may be like five facts about you writing it, five facts about the process. It doesn't have to be anything in the book.
Gotcha.
So five interesting facts about your new book open. Okay, here's how this goes, Nate. Five facts. Fact one.
Oh, and now I go with the facts?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you go.
I thought you were going to like model the whole thing first. Okay, perfect. Fact one is the idea for this book came to me at a Comfort Inn in Rawlins, Wyoming.
Stop. Okay. Two.
I was not originally going to explore psychedelic assisted therapy as a possible modality of opening, but somewhere along the way, it became obvious that I had to.
God, I wish I knew that. Three.
This book is my fourth book.
Love it. Four.
While writing this book, once I finished, I realized I had to keep writing. So I started a new book with my wife, which will be another relationship book that I've been writing concurrently.
I love it. And number five.
Number five is I am hopeful that this book creates a different conversation, that we stop talking so much about how much we hate each other and start talking to each other. And that's like the whole, the big goal.
I'm going to give some yes, yes, yes to that. Let's keep that conversation alive. I'm so glad you wrote it. I should have done this at the beginning of the show because now I want to know about the psychedelic journey. I have so many more questions, but we'll have to read the book in order to find out, totally. Right? So, okay, where can everyone find you? Where can they get the book? I know they're going to have questions. I know they're going to want to know more. see the other four or the other three books that you have. So where can they find you?
Yeah, the best place to find me is nateklemp.com. That's my website. So you'll see links to the book. The book should be available everywhere, Amazon, you know, Barnes and Noble, etc., local bookstores. And we also, my wife and I do a newsletter once every week or two that's totally free that you can sign up for there. That's just really like tips, tools, strategies for relationships, for living a better life. So that's the best way to kind of get into my orbit of what I'm up to.
I love it. We'll put all the links, obviously, in the show notes for you. Buy this book open. Buy it. Let's have this conversation of love. Let's be open, which was what your intention when we started today. And I really can't wait to read about the psychedelics. So make sure you get this book wherever you get books. I'm so glad. John Miles, who's also been on the show, introduced us to you. So thank you, John Miles, for this intro. And I really cannot wait to see where you take this conversation.
Well, thank you, Erin. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Peeps, what a show. I literally could have made this a two-part series, a two-day talk. I could have him on a panel. I could talk to him at length about this because I know it's a topic that we all struggle with, the distractions that we are approached with on a daily basis, the feelings we feel during a political race, the feelings we feel when it comes to election time, the feelings that we have had during election times all probably came up for you during this episode. I'm talking about my own experience here, but I'm sure if I'm feeling it, you're feeling it. So here is your homework. You know, I like to give you a tangible. I want you to take one of the practices that Dr. Nate put into place today, whether it's putting away your phone and spending time away from it, closing yourself off from technology, or if it's the opposite, if it's binging technology and making it not such this royal shiny object in your life, choose one of the two and actually implement this activity and see how you feel afterward. As I mentioned in the show, I've been putting my phone away in a different part of my house from 5 to 8 o'clock every night. So I spend that time with my husband and my son. And it has truly given me so much clarity, just those 3 hours. Can you schedule a trip that you might have coming up where you don't check email, you don't check social media? It's just you and your family. What can you do to give yourself that closure from technology? And if you're feeling more of the opposite, give yourself a weekend to binge, so you go in the opposite direction and you don't feel like you need this binge or, as he said, that dopamine dessert all the time. In any way, shape, or form that you choose to do this homework, just know I'm so proud of you for showing up for yourself, for hitting play on today's episode, for giving yourself this time for personal and professional development. I'm so, so proud of you. And you know what I'm going to say? Keep failing, keep improving, because this world needs that very special it that only you can bring. I'll see you next time. Improve it.